This is the fourth session of a series on the ministry of laity, on which we are trying to take certain slices and look at the ministry of laity in a number of different ways. For a couple of you who may not have been here for the other session, we're affirming that we have been called, all of us, into ministry in the world. We are affirming that in our baptism, we have been ordained into ministry. In the first session, we did a lot of biblical and theological bases for supporting the ministry of laity in the world. And then we began looking at a number of different pieces of it. It's interesting to observe that how we use the word minister, where we, in English we have the verb and the noun spelled the same way, it always means the same thing. If we use the word pioneer, to pioneer means to settle in a new area. A pioneer is one who settles in a new area. The word witness, to witness means to tell what I have seen or heard, to relate, to tell an account. And one who is a witness is someone who has told what he or she has seen or heard. When we come to the word minister, it's interesting that if you look in the dictionary, the verb minister means to assist, to give aid to help. But the noun minister, the first definition, is one authorized to conduct a religious service. And that's the way in which we have kind of lost touch with our whole concept of ministry. So when we're talking about ministry of all people, we're talking about the service of all Christians in the world. We badly need to get a hold of this because it's drifted so far away from lay people that we've completely lost touch with it. The World Council of Churches at Evanston, Illinois, had a statement saying, "The time has come to make the ministry of the laity explicit, visible, and active in the world. The real battles of the faith today are being fought in factory shops, offices, and farms, in political parties, and government agencies, and counties, in countless homes, in the press, radio, and television, in the leadership of nations. Very often it is said that the church should go into these spheres of activity. But the truth is the church already is in these spheres in the persons of its laity." That's a fine statement, one I agree with very much. The only trouble is it was made in 1954, and we still have a long way to go in terms of helping people see that we are called to be ministers in those various spheres of activity. Now, what we've been doing this week is taking the section of Luke in which Jesus proclaims his own ministry, taking item by item, and trying to see how that can be expanded or blown up to offer various kinds of ministries for people today. We've said that, as St. Luke has pointed out, that we have different gifts, we are called to different kinds of ministry. We aren't all called to do the same thing. But the point is that we want to try to help people find out what are my gifts and how do I connect those gifts with an intentional kind of ministry so I can connect faith and life. So going back again to the proclamation that Jesus made of his ministry, in the fourth chapter, he had been baptized by John, he had gone in the wilderness. He returned from the wilderness and was about to begin his ministry. He went into the synagogue, got up to speak, was handed the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and he read from the 61st chapter of Isaiah. It goes like this: "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me, He has sent me to announce good news to the poor, to proclaim release for prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to let the broken victims go free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." He folded the scroll, handed over to the assistant, and said, "Today in your sight this has been fulfilled." Now that was a very radical thing to be proclaiming, because the section of Isaiah that he was reading was a description of the new Jerusalem, the new order, as the ideal way society would be ordered in that time. And it was a very radical kind of thing. And to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor is to proclaim the Jubilee year. So this evening we want to focus on the section which he refers to, "Let the broken victims go free." It's interesting to note that that section is not in Isaiah, in the Isaiah section. It's a section that is in Luke, but not in Isaiah. and I really have not been able to find out why that this section is given to us in Luke, but was not in the Old Testament section. The New English Bible talks about let the broken victims go free. The Jerusalem Bible says to set the downtrodden free. Revised Standard Version says to set at liberty those who are oppressed. The Good News Bible says to set free the oppressed. The King James Version says to set at liberty those that are bruised. You can get a number of different nuances there in terms of what we're talking about. But let's just talk about what kind of people would we say, do we see that are oppressed today? Who would fall in the category of being oppressed people in our society today?
Women.
Women? Okay. Last night we talked about women, setting women free for ministry.
The aged.
Aged? Okay. What way are aged oppressed?
Well, the people who are poor and have adequate funds to buy food. They live on cat food and whatever they can afford to buy, which just isn't adequate. Many of them have lost their homes because of high taxes. They can't afford to pay their taxes. I call that oppressed.
All right. Okay.
Victims of a system that lets some people become very wealthy and others barely be able to live in sustenance.
Okay.
Political or institutional victims. I mean, that takes in a lot of people.
Yeah. Are you speaking economically primarily, Mary?
Well, I just think third, fourth, fifth world people as being broken individual, bruised, oppressed people, because there is an oppressor, someone that is keeping them down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, and victims of political or economic system.
Would this apply, you said third world countries, does this apply in our country also? Okay, a long list. A number of these, and perhaps all of them really, can be related to a kind of institutionalization or a systematic kind of thing that creates the oppression, right? That the way our system functions, these people are hurt. So therefore, if we're talking about setting free these people, then we have to talk about institutions. We have to talk about how we can deal with change in the institutions. Now, in dealing with institutional change, you can argue that the institutional change comes best if done from within the institution. That is, Christians within an institution are the ones who can best effect change, or people outside the institution can cause it to change. That's very good. That's a good point. Did you hear what she said? When you're in the institution, you're often blinded by it. I have a good, what I consider a good war story on that. A few years ago, there was a very serious flood in western Pennsylvania, and our Johnstown, Pennsylvania plant was flooded. It had been raining all night, all morning, and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they called all the managers of our company. I work for Bethlehem Steel. They called all the managers of the company together in our chart room and said the Johnstown plant had been wiped out by a flood. And went down a whole long list of things that had happened to the plant. This particular operation was knocked out, and something else was under 6 feet of water. And going down a long list of things that we couldn't be able to do because we couldn't make shipments of this product or that product. And thank goodness nobody was hurt, but it was all focusing on what was happening to the plant. And I was very intent in listening to this and absorbing the whole thing, the tremendous damage to the plant. And I went home that evening, and the 6 o'clock television was on as I walked in the room, and it was showing all the devastation done to the homes and other people in the Johnstown area. And it had never occurred to me sitting there in that room within our company. And we were so focusing on our own interest that it never occurred to me to ask, well, you know, what's happening to the people outside the plant? And it's such an easy way of getting hooked. I was very upset about that I was so narrow in my thinking. And a few weeks later, in the Lutheran magazine, There was an article about the effect the Johnstown flood had had on LCA congregations in the area. It named three churches, LCA churches in Johnstown, had been wiped out. Not a word about other churches that had been wiped out, or Jewish congregations that had been hurt, anything like that. Just our own. So we, in an institution, I think it, you tend so much to focus on your own, like you're the center of the universe. And I'm not saying that you can't work on change within an institution, but it's so easy to blind ourselves on the reason why things are the way they are and the difficulty, impracticality of changing, that it takes a very strong person, I think, to be able to effect real good change within an institution. Now, a few years ago, I don't know, are any of you familiar with the Metropolitan Associates Program of Philadelphia? A number of years ago, an ecumenical group in Philadelphia tried a program in which they brought together people who were in some of the major policy areas of institutions of Philadelphia. They had some people from the banking industry, they had people from the government, some of the major retailers in the area, some people from the insurance firm. Philadelphia has a number of insurance companies. They brought some of these lay people together who were very sensitive lay people, and they said, we want to help, we want to equip you to bring about change in the institution in which you work. That's going to be an experimental kind of thing. The idea being that people within the institution are in the best position to create some change. The program went along for a number of years, but it was extremely difficult being able to help these people find the logical ways to create change within the institution and get enough support for them to do it. The successes that they were able to record in terms of change was very, very minor. And perhaps the experiment broke up too soon, I don't know, but at least it was a kind of a learning experience that the concept of changing the institution from within perhaps is easier said than done, and that perhaps sometimes we really have to focus on changing from the outside. Yes?
I think I was thinking of broader institutions in terms of, like, a government, that it would be more effective to have Native Americans trying to institute changes in government policy or whatever for themselves than it would be for me to
be
there. Mm-hmm. You know, that it would be more effective if they were saying, we need this, you know, for our people, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Well, you cannot give someone their freedom. As long as you give it to them, they're not free. They must assert their freedom.
I was just going to add, Paul Freire makes a very strong statement that that if the struggle for freedom from oppression is going to ever result in anything, the struggle has to come from the oppressed. And they have to be struggling for freedom for both the oppressed and the oppressors. And he just very strongly says that it can never come from the oppressors, because as a totality, they will never give that up.
What kind of change are you speaking about? You know, I've been listening and I keep hearing the word change, but that's as far as it goes. You know, what's involved in this change process?
Okay. Process. We've listed a number of different kinds of people who are oppressed
right.
in our society. And we are trying to examine what are the conditions that have caused that oppression and what kind of change can be made in institutions to eliminate that oppression. Now, either by the people themselves causing that to change or by other people helping with that change.
And institutions would be defined as what? A place of work, place of, you know, how could you, if it was a place of work, how could you bring change for the aged if you were, you know, I don't know, at a company that makes steel? You know, I'm kind of lost as far as that is. What institution can we initiate this change into?
Well, I think it depends upon what the particular type of person, you know, what the group is that we're working with. For aid with the aged, for example, there is an issue in terms of companies, and that is the whole issue of retirement. Whether or not people should be forced to take retirement at a particular age. We raised it from 65 to 70. And you know, whether that's a just thing for elderly or not is something that, you know, leave it to you to decide. But if it is an unjust thing, then how can that change be done, either within the institution or within society through laws changing it?
Since at the beginning you said you were going to be open to a lot of discussion,
sure.
Would you mind if I ask a question?
Sure.
How is this, you know, what kind of means can you effectively bring this change about? Is it a large voice, you know, where you try to stir up a lot of other people feeling the same way, or is it, you know, just when you're asked for your opinion, if you're a manager or something, you speak your piece and leave it, let the other people pick it up instead of preaching it around? Understand?
Not quite. I think you have to be specific. Okay. What I plan to do is go through some steps that I found important to change. Maybe that will help, and if not, then we can get back to that.
Right. Yes. Can I ask a kind of a question about those steps? Would you consider those steps to be very similar to what a body of people does to become a nation? Is the sequence similar as far as identifying themselves and identifying something,
you
know, that they
I hadn't
want
thought
to
change? Maybe, let me go through it. Maybe I hadn't thought about that. Maybe they are, maybe not. I'm not sure. Let me just go through them. Incidentally, for me, there's been two helpful people in terms of being change agents. One is Saul Alinsky, who wrote Rules for Radicals and Reveille for Radicals. And he's a, I find a fascinating person to read because he's got a great sense of humor in terms of the ways in which he causes change to happen. The other one is Lyle Schaller, who has a very nice book called The Change Agent, which he also gives recipes for creating change. And of course, the recipes differ depending upon the circumstances. Saul Alinsky had advice for certain kinds of things. And I recall one time I was in a restaurant in the airport in Chicago, had breakfast there, and when I sat down to order my breakfast, the waitress said, "Do you want some coffee?" And I said, "No, later." So then I ordered my breakfast and orange juice and cereal and so on. And then when I said, "I'd like to have coffee with my breakfast." So she brought the breakfast and not the coffee. And then she was very busy and she came by. I said, "Could I please have my coffee?" And she just nodded her head, but she didn't pay any attention to me because she'd really offered, as far as she was concerned, I had my chance to get the coffee first thing. Well, remembering one of Saul Alinsky's rules in terms of getting attention to work against the self-interest of the person, he recommends raising your voice in a restaurant so that the waitress is embarrassed. So I thought, well, I'll give it a try. So after politely asking her several times could I have my coffee and no answer, finally I mustered up my courage and in this restaurant said, "Waitress, could I please have my coffee?" And everybody looked at me and I was really quite embarrassed. And she was shocked. So,
your coffee.
Huh? I sure did. She came over and she banged it down and spilled all over me. So I got my coffee, but it wasn't the way I wanted to get it.
But she didn't get a tip.
So sometimes those things can happen unsuccessfully too. But anyway, Alinsky and Lyle Schaller have some good books on change. Well, some of the things that, that we have found in terms of our working our way through change, and a little suggestions are, I think it's important first to sharpen the focus of what you're trying to do. Too often people say we want to do something for the aged, something for the, well, what do you want to do? You know, the sharper the focus is in terms of what specifically do we want to do. Do we want to get a home for the elderly in our county? And specifically, you know, what size and so on, and then sharpen also the focus in terms of who are the barriers to getting this thing done. I think too often groups looking at change take too large a piece of it and try to work on something very large instead of focusing very sharply.
Phil, isn't that also kind of a cop-out? I mean, most of us look at number one. It's so easy to be concerned about the aged in general. But if all of a sudden we have to narrow our sights and say, well, let's get this bad nursing home out of the county or out of the community, then that takes a lot of effort, and so most of us are just kind of committed in general to things. But
yeah.
I think probably we fall short with even number one. I don't know what the others are.
Yeah.
See, I think for women, here's a very good case. You can talk about improving conditions, improving equality for women. That's general. If you say, get ERA passed in those states where it has not yet been passed, Illinois and so on, Virginia, then you're becoming much more specific. You can more specifically define what the opposition is and the things that have to be done. Then we found it's very important. Some of these things are so very obvious, it seems ridiculous to mention. We found it's very important to form support groups for what you're trying to do. The group, the coming together of some people interested in this particular venture, I think is very important. One or two people working alone, it gets very lonely, very discouraging, and the ideas are rather thin, and just doesn't seem to mesh. But with a support group where there's a built-in accountability, where people are accountable to each other for in terms of you do this, I'll do this, and so on, we come together next week, we're going to meet and see how things are going, that builds in a certain kind of momentum that gets things done. Third thing, I think it's important that to accept people where they are. Both in terms of the people who are working with you and the people who are presenting blocks. Too often we become idealistic and assume that because we have the vision of the way the change should come about, everybody has that vision, and that is not true. Going back to an example period when we were working in the whole fair housing area many years ago, it was very clear to us what had to be done because our eyes were open when we tried innocently, naively I should say, we tried to get housing for a black couple in our area. And we assumed it was okay. And then our eyes were open when we saw how it wasn't going to work at all, how the blocks were really there. And as we mentioned this to other people, they understood that there should be open housing, but they really didn't understand the depth of it and the real serious blocks that were there until they themselves became involved in escorting people, trying to find housing for people where it was prohibited, where it was banned. So I think we have to assume that, you know, not everybody is where we are in the terms of commitment, and we have to let them develop in terms of their style gradually. Next thing is develop skills. I think too frequently we try to reinvent the wheel. Too frequently we try to affect change that has been done someplace before by people who know how to do it, and we don't go out and look for that kind of resource in terms of somebody coming in and say, well, we did this, we had this problem, this is what we did. It's kind of interesting. I was reading Larry Rasmussen's book on Bonhoeffer two nights ago in terms of the plot to assassinate Hitler. And it was very clear that they had, you know, they sharpened the focus, they had a support group. Well, I guess they kind of accepted where people were, the generals and the leaders, the elite came aboard. But the one thing they didn't do, they didn't get a skilled person in bombs. They didn't have anybody who knew how to do an effective job of building a bomb and getting it delivered. So they lacked the skill to do the technical part of what they were trying to do. The theory was there, commitment was there, you know, they saw the injustice, they saw it had to be corrected, but in terms of the actual skill to deliver the project, they neglected to a very important feature, and that was somebody who knew how to operate the bomb. Saul Alinsky is very strong that we must work on the person's self-interest. If there is a block there, some group is blocking what you're trying to change, you've got to look at their self-interest. What needs to be done to cause that person to change in terms of his or her own self-interest? And as I said, Saul Alinsky has some delightful examples of how that can be done. He makes one account, I forget the city, but there was one city where their civic orchestra was not hiring any minority people. It was an all-white orchestra. And there were a group of people who felt this was unjust. They should open it up to black performers. So what they did is they encouraged more and more people to eat a lot of garlic before they went to orchestra that night. And it began to grow, this movement began to grow, and there were more people sitting in the orchestra with this heavy smell of garlic. And other people were beginning to complain about it. And when the complaints got to be too heavy, then the orchestra management began to get the message that unless they began to do something, that they were going to have a lot of heavy odor of garlic in the orchestra for a long time. He also talks about a bank that was not being cooperative in terms of employing people. And so they got a group of people who began lining up the bank windows and blocking the windows from people coming in and doing their business at the bank, really jamming up the system. And Alinsky is very strong on this. If you jam up a person's system, they see that it's in their own self-interest to do something so that that problem, that block, is removed. And therefore, they can see that in their own self-interest, perhaps they should go along and make the changes being sought. Then, I think it's important to check the ethics as we go along. Sometimes get carried away with things. Here again, getting back into the fair housing period. I was one who believed very much in educating people. Get the people of the community together in fair housing meetings and show them the injustice and show them what was wrong and what had to be done and so on. So we had all kinds of meetings, but nobody came except the people who were already committed. The people who weren't interested never showed up, so we weren't educating anybody. But we did recognize that if we somehow get one or two of the insurance real estate companies to recognize their self-interest is at stake, then perhaps we could affect some change. Now, one of the things that we had to do was to show the real estate people that they were breaking the law by not complying with the fair housing laws, and therefore that meant that we had to do some straw buying. And straw buying is deceptive. Straw buying is where you get two white couples, in this case a black couple, and you go out. There's a place available, the white couple goes in to make sure it's available. The black couple then goes in to look it over, and if it's a place they really want and they ask for it, and it's not available for them, then they leave, and another white couple goes in immediately afterwards. If it's still available, then you put some deposit in the place, hold it, and report the discrimination to whatever the local authorities are. Now that is deception. As a white couple, you're going in there, you're deceiving. You're really not interested in buying that place, you're checking. And for us, that was a big step to take, to go out and participate in deception and not be telling the truth when you're looking for something. But we worked our way through it and decided that it was something that the greater good had to be served through doing this, so we were willing in this case to tell lies in order to try to effect the change.
Did it work?
Pardon?
Did it work?
Well, in the case of getting people who were discriminating, yes, we were able to bring some cases in the court and people were fine. That wasn't the thing that actually made the change, though. And then the final thing is, this you can't always do, but work. I think we have to work very hard so that everyone is a winner. That you don't have a winner and a loser. If you can possibly work it so that the change is made so that everybody sees, by golly, this was good for us. Now, in the case of the fair housing example again, we were able, through a reward punishment system, the first real estate man who gave us the least amount of indication of cooperating, we got as many people as we could to list with that person, make our listings with him. And we encouraged people not to list with those realtors who were discriminating. And so once that began to grow, this fellow got all kinds of listings, and then others began to follow, and we began to break the logjam. But when we moved and we left home, when we left our home and moved up to Allentown, where we are now, I went to this realtor, listed our home with him, and told him why we were doing it, because he was the first one to break ranks and begin selling to minority people. And he said, well, you know, he said, I want to thank you for listing your home with me, but I also want to thank you for making us do what we knew we had to do. In other words, he was a winner. His conscience had been corrected, I should say. You know, he knew he wasn't doing the right thing, but now it had been corrected so that he was happy. He was a winner, and we all were winners in this particular case. That doesn't always happen. You do have winners and losers. Now, you know, I'm sure there's still discrimination going on in housing in that area. Even just the very fact of economic differences is discrimination going on. But at least it was one kind of a process in which we were able to go through. Now, what I would like to suggest for the few minutes we have, why don't we pick an issue that we would like, let's work our way through, an issue that we'd like to deal with and see how we would go about affecting the change in that. Do you have any specific issues that come to your mind?
I have a question
first. Yeah, okay, sure.
I'm assuming that this change is being done from a Christian point of view rather than a humanitarian point of view, you know, just a general humanitarian point of view. Am I right or am I wrong, you know? Is there any way you can effectively bring in the fact that you are a Christian and not just a Joe humanitarian who wants to see everybody smiling and happy and stuff like that?
Well, in our, getting back to our example of fair housing, we had a group of people of very diverse backgrounds and motives. We had humanitarians in our group. I believe that God works in this world not only through the church, not only through Christians, but does work in the world in many different ways. So I wouldn't want to knock at all the work of humanitarian, non-Christian people. To me, the difference is that in terms of our own Christian conviction, humanitarian to me has the whole load on his or her back. If there's failure, there's failure. We know we're not called to be successful, we're called to be faithful. And so I think we can go out and take chances and lose and not feel the whole thing is, you know, the whole world's crushed down our shoulders. So to me, the difference is that, and I'm not sure if you're implying that we should be giving a commercial for why.
No, I'm not implying that at all. I'm just, you know, when I hear the word ministry, I agree with you that it's not just through the church. And what you were discussing sounds like some good effective ways. But also, you know, I see it as a chance that there is opportunity to go beyond that than to just do the change and do witnessing. You don't have to do a commercial. Mm-hmm. I think when you have a setup that you have interested people under one common goal, that certainly is a place where it can be done in a non-commercial way, where there are feelings there that can be, you know, added to. So I was just wondering.
But what would you do differently as a Christian? I mean, aren't Christians humanitarians? How would you do it any differently because you were a Christian?
Nothing. But, you know, my problem is, and you know, where the humanitarian lacks so much, even though he's doing a lot, than the Christian because he's lacking Christ. And how can you tie Christ into their lives too? You understand? The humanitarian is doing something right.
But don't you think Christ is working through them? Christ uses non-Christians for his work.
I agree with that, but wouldn't it be so much better if they were then Christians, if they, you know, if that was introduced to?
Well, I think it would be better from their viewpoint if they were. I think, you know, the world would be so much more livable for them, but, yes?
Yeah, this is a little different subject. I don't want to change.
Okay.
I just wanted to raise that question. I'm curious as to how much of it is due, you know, is Christian and how much is humanitarian. You know, that was my question. I didn't mean to start a big scuttle.
I assumed from your theme for the week, by taking the first thing that Jesus said publicly to describe his ministry, And we've been taking Luke 4, 16, 17, 18, and a quote from Isaiah 61, that when he described what he saw as ministry, those were issues that we might call humanitarian issues, but that if we are Christ-like or disciples or followers of the one who has described ministry for us, they include these issues. Now, the question can then, a legitimate question can be, do we participate in a different way or what have you, but it seems to me that it has clearly said that we are at least humanitarians, and that the ministry of the church includes the kind of things that we have on the blackboard, and that we will be with some other people who might be there for different reasons, but those issues will bring us together, and we are there in Christ's name and because of our faith. So it seems to me there's a point of agreement, and then there is a point of legitimate discussion beyond that, but that you have kind of based the whole thing of Christian ministry in Christ's own description of what he saw as ministry. Is that
yes,
correct or
yeah.
fair?
Okay. Ben?
No, when I look at this chart, and there's one thing, I don't know if it would be to add or if it's also implied there, but is the sense of solidarity with these people who are oppressed. I think the danger often has been as people who in some ways are not oppressed, you know, we'll pick like Native Americans and find this little chart without first really understanding what they're thinking, what their needs are, how they see it, how they want to fork out their liberation. And I felt a little of this in the whole South Africa debate. You know, how much are we talking about how we can help them, and how much are we asking how can we stand in solidarity with them first, and then finally really take our orders from them, which means we have to work through a lot of our own racism, a lot of our own self-pride, and just be servants of the oppressed in their struggle for liberation.
Yeah. I think in most cases that can happen. There are some mm-hmm. cases where it can. Right away mm-hmm. to my mind comes Amnesty International.
Right.
Where we are, there's no possible direct contact you can have with those people. All we're doing is writing letters, and
yeah.
hoping occasionally something does happen. But I think you're right. In most cases, we can make that contact and give that feeling of solidarity.
Yeah.
And yes and no, I guess. You know, in the fair housing thing too, you create the situation so that the people coming in have the open housing.
I guess for myself, when I consider issues like this and I start to feel strongly about something, and the reason why I tied this on to the process of people becoming a nation is that you tend to have something that you hate, okay? You tend to have an enemy, at least for the nation process to go through. That's what draws the people together. And the thing that I tend to do is when I do identify with an injustice, a lot of times I tend to develop a feeling of hatred for the oppressed. So sometimes I wonder if I don't trade off my hatred for Iran with a hatred for multinational corporations. And I really don't see that as being a Christian viewpoint. So I see that in myself as being a real danger in taking off and not really spending any time in identifying with or understanding the people who are the so-called oppressors, which many times they probably don't even understand that they are, as you pointed out at the beginning. I think that's a real big trap, at least it is for me.
Yeah.
I tend to fly off on the handle and become an easy radical without understanding the total problem and everyone who's involved in that problem.
Yeah, well, I was perhaps alluding to that when I say accept people where they are. The oppressor very often doesn't realize he's the oppressor. It's so easy for me, like you, to assume there's an evil person.
Yeah.
He knows he's
evil.
He's got to
know evil. Why don't they understand that?
Right. But to recognize that most people don't. They're just so insensitive to the whole thing, they don't realize that. And the other thing is, in terms of checking your ethics, is you know, making sure that this generation of hatred doesn't come about. Yes, John?
That's interesting. I don't know if you've read Reveille for Radicals or ever listened to Alinsky already. I respect him also. I've heard him and I've read it. Bill's list does not include one principle that Alinsky always said, and that may be because we're bringing a Christian approach that he didn't have. He would call us naive unless there was a point. Rub raw the resentments and find an enemy. You do not mobilize back of the yard until you can name University of Chicago. You will not get people unless you make an enemy, name it, and rub it in until they're white hot. I mean, that's Alinsky, and I'm not sure that's Christianity. So Bill's list left that out.
Yeah, although I was talking about focusing, on the problem and also the blocks to it. But I agree it can be self-defeating if we talk about finding an enemy. Yes?
I think that's the same part of Alinsky that I disagree with. And because it doesn't fit with my Christian understanding, and also because I think it leaves out an important part of the process. I think if any change is going to really be effective, it has to be a solidarity with the oppressed. It has to be a realization of harm. Okay, the oppressed themselves have to come to the realization that they are oppressed first. And they have to come to understand that. I think, maybe to simplify it, when a group of people are oppressed, they see their life as a set of limits, and those boundaries are solid, and they feel like there's no way they can do anything about them. They're hitting against walls everywhere they turn. To turn those walls into a challenge that they can try and change, they have to start to understand where the oppression comes from and understand the process of oppression. At that point, I think they can start to see things that at one point they saw as a hopeless limit as a challenge, and then they can start moving forward. If they don't come to that understanding, if there isn't, and I think the way we fit into that is in a dialogue relationship, taking the problem and analyzing it together with them, but almost always leaving them in the leading position. When they come to that realization, when you can start to understand it, only then can they move forward. Too often we've tried to change for people. We've set up a system, and until they can understand and see for themselves and believe that, yes, change is possible and see how it fits together, it's not going to work. I think at that point, there's also a realization that not only are they freeing themselves, they're also freeing the oppressor. And then that can be an act of love rather than an act of hate against an enemy outside somewhere. That feeling of that hate response is an earlier response that you see all through oppression, that's struggling against some outside force that's holding them down, but not an understanding.
I think also, though, we have to work for a society where oppression does not exist. How should I say? When you were talking, the levels of giving of Maimonides, do you ever read that in terms of the lowest, the first level of giving is to give someone exactly what they ask. Next level is to give someone more than they ask. Next level up is to give someone something you see that they need before they ask, and so on goes above. The highest level is to create a situation where people don't have to ask, where you don't have the oppressed even having to assert their freedom and so on. And I think that is something we also have to work for. That's very idealistic, but I think that's the kind of society we want to create. Yes, ma'am?
A couple of examples. Not sure how it's fitting in now, but when we moved into the District of Columbia to work among minorities in the district, we were in essence told, why don't you go back to the white suburbs? That's the one that's creating the problem. When our daughter went to Mexico this last semester and visited political prisoners who had had their hands cut off or who were tortured periodically with electric shock, you know, she said in my naivete, I said, what can we do to help? And they said, well, don't stay down here, go back to your country and straighten out some systems that are causing this down here. I don't think that's the kind of thing that we like to hear. Again, it's taking our clues from the oppressed person. It's much harder to go to the white suburbs or come back to America and talk to people about systems and changing institutions than it is to go down and go into D.C. and make sure they have a tutoring program or adequate housing or all that stuff. And white liberals are a dime a dozen, but the person that's willing to go back and talk and take the the guff that we're going to get from our own kind because they don't want to change, I think is a very difficult thing to do.
And that's the point where I think it becomes solidarity, because then you're letting them take the lead, you're listening to them, you're going to learn, but then to come back and affect the change where you can be most effective.
Yes?
Do you ever get any feedback from the relatives that you, when you institute your blockbusting?
Yes.
As to the economic loss in the houses they were trying to sell? We're trying to sell our house, and our neighbor's trying to sell his house. He listed it a while, he couldn't sell it, so he leased it to a colored family. Well, a few years ago, we've been pretty wild about that. Now we look at it and we realize it's something that's there, it's legal, and so forth. But still, we're not real happy about the situation. And kind of wondered what these, you know, when you go in with your blockbusting apparatus there, what economic loss you cause to the rest of the people in the area.
Yeah, well, of course, some of the blockbusting was done by realtors themselves in order to get things moving.
But in your case, you actually instituted a direct case.
And I would, most of the reaction we got from most of the realtors was, don't talk to me about that. I'm not going to do something that's going to hurt my business. If I begin listing blacks, my business is going to suffer. People won't give me any business. So that was their general reaction.
Did it lower property values? Most of the time it raised them. Did it not?
John, that was mixed. We found areas where property values did go down.
Is that right?
And the realtors really had a bonanza because they were selling, a lot of houses were turning over. People started leaving,
yeah.
And there's a lot of houses to sell. And that was great for the realtors. They were happy to see that. But there were other areas where it didn't. And studies were made showing, I think, both directions. Okay. Well, we're going to have a. I guess we won't. I'm going to try to have a case study. I think one of the areas right now that I see that we're going to be involved in when we get back from Holden is the Cuban situation. There are a lot of Cubans now who are in camps, and there's a real resistance right now toward settling Cubans. And because of the unemployment situation, and because some people feel that Castro pulled a dirty trick on us, and all this and that there is a block there now in terms of resettling Cubans. But they're in these camps, and you know we've got to help them get started. And it's a situation where, the way we're operating, they cannot get out of the camp and assert their freedom. They do need some help. They do need sponsors. And so we're going to have to work our way through that. And I know right now what the block is going to be when we go to look for jobs for these people. We're going to have to find ways to get that done. So that was one of the things we could have worked our way through, but we're just about it.
Are you speaking as Bethlehem Steel or as Bill Deal?
No, not Bethlehem Steel. That's myself, yeah.
Now we live in an area where we have thousands of illegal Mexicans, and they're let in politically because if you and I want to get across the border into Canada, they can make it pretty tough. But the farm states in the Southwest want labor, and that frontier down there is wide open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they get one forest ranger or whatever it is every 100 miles.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, that's a political thing.
The climate is not too good for settling Cubans in that area then either.
Well, they might settle quite a bunch.
Well, okay. What we're saying is this is another area in which some people can see their ministry. And I think it's very important, you know, getting back to the question you were asking perhaps about the humanitarians. I think it's so important. We have so many people who are trying to do things, good things and so on, who don't make a connection between what they are doing and their community of faith in terms of making a connection, seeing that I am called into this particular kind of ministry at this time and place. And that's very sad. So many people that are lacking that connection, not seeing the connection between Sunday faith and the weekday world. And I think we have to find ways to help people see what you're doing is you're calling into ministry in terms of change agent, and we affirm that and we support you and want to help you in that. And when those connections begin to come, then the people will be much more alive to their calling as Christians in this time and place. That's one of the things we have to work on. Okay, it's time for Vespers.
No, you've got one last question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm wondering, is there ever any time you just say no to a particular problem? You know, like, it seems like there's always so many problems. I mean, can you say no that, hey, I don't agree with this, even the...
Sure.
You know, that's something that, you know, with the Cubans, you know, just, you look at it as an American, see all these other people coming in, you know, and we have jobs for our own people, and that's a struggle I usually have. Where does the, you know, I don't know even how to say it, where does the American end and the Christian take over? You know, making
well,
these decisions,
asking,
they're tough decisions.
Yeah, you're asking a couple of questions there.
Yeah.
Your first question, do you ever say no? Yeah, I think you do say no. I think that, again, is the whole business of trying to sharpen what your talents are, what your abilities are, what your opportunities are, you know, where God has placed you in this world.
Possibly.
And focus on that, and then you can say no to things that really don't fit your talents and don't fit the position where you are. Mm-hmm. I think when people come to understand ministry, it doesn't mean they pick up and leave and go someplace else. It means that they sharpen doing what they're doing where they are. So I think in that case, yeah, you've obviously got to say no to something.